My name is Kim Solga. I am honored to be here and honored to be chairing the first plenary session of this PSI 16. Again, I want to say welcome to Toronto. Thank you for not being the G20. Thank you for being here before the fence goes up. We're all a little bit intimidated by it. This is Performing Publics. This is the plenary session that tells us all what this conference is going to be about and sets the mood. And I just want to say very cheekily that as one of the three people who apparently originally envisioned Performing Publics, I'm looking forward to taking credit for all of your brilliant theoretical ideas this week. Thank you. All right, okay. I am going to introduce each of our panelists at the top right now, and then we're going to go in the order in the program, which is Shannon Jackson first, and then Janine Marchessault and Michael Procopau second, and Jose Munoz third. All right, Shannon Jackson, as many of you know, is professor of rhetoric and professor and immediate past chair of the Department of Theater, Dance, and Performance Studies at UC Berkeley, where she is now incoming director of Berkeley's Arts Research Center. Along with numerous articles, conference organizing, and performances, Shannon has published two books, Lines of Activity in 2000 and Professing Performance in 2004. A new book called Social Works, Performing Art, Supporting Publics is, as of this week, at press with Routledge. She is also completing a new book on intermedia performance through the work of the Builders Association to be published by MIT Press. So please join me now quickly in welcoming Shannon Jackson.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming here early this
Shannon,
morning.
Shannon, sorry, do you want me to let you go and then we do each person individually? Or sorry. No, it's fine. I got everyone to clap
right,
for you. That is actually a cue.
No, that's
not to worry.
And I do respond to cues. Okay,
go ahead. Not to worry. All right, let's. I'll introduce Janine, Michael, and Jose, and then I'll hold your applause until the end, and then Shannon can go. All right. So Janine Marchessault is Canada Research Chair in Art, Digital Media, and Globalization at York University. Her research and teaching focus on contemporary theories of media, history of science and technology, and urban studies. She is the co-founder of the Future Cinema Lab, a research facility devoted to new stories for new screens, as well as the director of the Visible City Archive, a comparative study of public art and architecture in 21st century cities. She's the author of Marshall McLuhan, Cosmic Media in 2005 and co-editor of Fluid Screens, Expanded Cinema in 2007. Also Locating, Migrating Media in 2010. Dr. Marchessault is a founding member of the Public Access Curatorial Collective and the journal Public Art Culture Ideas and is a past president of the Film Studies Association of Canada. And as you'll hear shortly, she was a co-curator of the Leona Drive project. Also a co-curator of the project, Michael Procopau holds a PhD in history from Harvard, and his areas of specialty include North American material culture, architectural and design history, critical theory, and aesthetics. Currently, he's a faculty member at OCAD University and teaches in the York-Ryerson Joint Graduate Program in Communication and Culture. Between 2003 and 2007, he served as the curator at the Design Exchange, Canada's only museum dedicated to the documentation, conservation, and study of post-1945 Canadian industrial design. Michael joined LOT Experiments in Urban Research in 2008, and he's currently working on a project about middle-class taste in North America, 1940 to 1975. Okay, so hold your applause for Michael and Janine. And finally, we have Jose Munoz on the end there. Jose is chair of the Department of Performance Studies at the Tisch School of the Arts, New York University. He's the author of Disidentifications, Queers of Color and the Performance of Politics, Cruising Utopia, the Then and There of Queer Futurity, and the forthcoming Feeling Brown. He has edited various volumes of performance theory, most recently a special issue of the journal Women and Performance, titled Between Affect and Psychoanalysis. And along with Anne Pellegrini, he is the co-editor of the Sexual Cultures book series for NYUP. Okay, let's thank them all for being here. Thank you guys so much. And Shannon, that's your cue.
Okay. Thank you again. Thank you, Kim. And my thanks also to all of the organizers, in particular Lisa and Laura Levin, for inviting us all here, inviting me to be here, and for all their coordination. My thoughts about Performing Publics today comes from a couple of directions. One, it comes from the fact that, as Kim just said, I recently finished a book called Social Works, Performing Art, Supporting Publics, which is a project that seeks to analyze a social turn in contemporary art, trying to put a variety of group-based, time-based, socially oriented, experiments in art making within the frame of performance studies. And it also, I think, comes from having just stepped down as after a term as department chair of theater, dance, and performance studies at UC Berkeley. That is, as a person responsible for supporting a curriculum and production apparatus and the support for critique of group-based, time-based, very often socially oriented experiments in art making. And so the situation of, and the particular position of being someone who endures the creativity and headache of stage managing an artistic and educational apparatus is also partly something that informs my thoughts today. But it also comes from the fact that my department is located in a university system in California whose crisis has spawned all kinds of renewed conversation about what the social is, what the public is, what a public institution is, and what new kinds of social turns in all dimensions of public life are necessary to sustain that life for a new century. Interestingly enough, the support and animation of a discussion of the role of public education has also required its own production apparatus. And if you have it in you to stay through till Sunday morning, you'll also get to hear from other UC faculty and graduate students who have been actively involved in the group-based, time-based, socially oriented experiments in art-making, event planning, and what might be called the stage management of public and counter-public spheres in California. So in my brief time today, I want to describe some of the pursuits and paradoxes of the Social Works book, and then I'll conclude with some reflection about how those thought structures from that project have affected and been affected by California's wider discussion about the role of public education more generally. Along the way, I will also point up some of the unintended consequences of the language of opposition in a concept of both the public sphere and the counter-public sphere when it comes to relations with the state. The language of opposition resonates, of course, with the language of resistance that we find in socially engaged performance studies and its allied fields. While committed to the social goals that propelled such articulations, you'll see me also wondering about the effects of such language in our neoliberal moment, a moment when conservative discourses also oppose institutions as well. If the counter in counter-public sphere is reduced to the language of opposition, then we might find ourselves oddly in league with such forces. Indeed, it would seem that we need, to quote our call for papers for this conference, a model that is more affectively and critically nuanced in order to decide how we can oppose public institutions in the same breath that we call for their renewal. So first, let me just describe some contours of the Social Works project. While I consider a number of issues, I'm seeking, I think, two conceptual contributions to the discourse of social practice in art. And we could say that one is aesthetic and formal, and the other is socio-political for the moment, though I'll undo that pretty quickly. So first, in the first domain, I want to think about what it means, like many of you, to cross media, especially between visual art and performance forms. For me, this means tracking the differences amongst the disciplined histories of art making that structure both the practice and reception of interdisciplinary art making now. And two, I'm also interested in how that cross-media turn coincides with an impulse to social and public engagement in art making. Arguably, most everyone in this room is interested in art as some form of social and public engagement. And I'm more precisely interested in projects that bring to consciousness or imagine anew the infrastructural systems of support that sustain the social and public welfare of human beings. So let me take that first goal, the aesthetic and formal goal, for a bit. To analyze social practice and art across art forms is inevitably to engage a range of artistic practices, including those that more and less self-consciously reinvent the territory of sculpture, theater, dance, expanded cinema, architecture, and more. As a catch-all phrase for a variety of practices that performatively extend inherited art forms in space, duration, embodiment, and collectivity, social practices can induce all varieties of responses and readings. I find myself arguing that these responses depend upon different receivers' experiences with prior art forms. If, for instance, we understand a public art installation to be a revision of sculpture, we encounter it differently than if we understand it to be a revision of theater. And we will encounter it differently still if we understand it to be a revision of architecture. That is, sometimes our disciplined emplacement within prior traditions influences the language we use to describe a cross-disciplinary art-making practice. The same might go for experimental performance, whether cited in a theater, in a gallery, or in a street. To some, the fundamental inclusion of an artist's body in a gallery installation is formally innovative. To others, it appears only to be bad acting. To some, the dispersal of an art practice is an intriguing dematerialization, to use the language of visual art history. But to others, it is an assembly of bad sight lines. To some, a durational experiment is tediously slow. To others, it is a meditation on the nature of human endurance. Meanwhile, the language we might use to describe aesthetic expansion is equally varied. Community art, site-specific art, protest art, performance ethnography, social practice, relational aesthetics, and many other terms appear to track what art historians might call post-visual or post-studio, but what theater historians might call post-dramatic. Experimental art performances might all use visual, embodied, collective, durational, and spatial systems, but a critical sense of their innovation will differ depending upon what medium they understand themselves to be disrupting. That is, which medium is on the other end of whose post. Okay, so let me, having thought a bit about some of the aesthetic issues from with a certain kind of aesthetic discourse, let me elaborate a bit more on the social dimension of a project on social works. To analyze social practice in art is also inevitably to engage a range of political orientations and social goals, often orientations and goals that vary in their efforts at activism or their attempts to do good, or often in their attempts to ironize what we understand to be activism or ironize what we understand to be to do good. In parallel with the above discussion about art media, reception of these practices can depend upon receivers' relationships to the social issues provoked by the piece. At the same time, I'm most interested in situating these debates about the social within 20th and 21st century debates about social systems of governance and human care, especially in light of the rise of neoliberalism in a globalizing age. As a number of scholars and politicians, including many in this room, debate the continued relevance of state welfare models, as neoliberal conceptions of subjectivity advocate models of autonomous personhood free of such systems, the nature of the social is itself debated territory. The European Union debates the future of the welfare state and of Greece. The UK worries and wonders about the effects of a Cameron-Clegg coalition. And in Canada, similar concerns about the federal and provincial effects of its prime minister linger. The world watches as China mixes socialist governance and capitalist economics. The United States avows and disavows the role of federal welfare post-Katrina, and now the same occurs in our debates about healthcare, oil spills, and public education. In these and other local, national, and international conversations, interlocutors debate the possibilities and perils of sustaining interdependent models of human collectivity. Like many of us here today, my concern is about the effects of neoliberal structures that are both material and psychic. In particular, though, I find myself concerned with how a certain version of neoliberal individual autonomous models of freedom can paradoxically be embraced for their radicality, an embrace that artists and intellectuals might unwittingly find ourselves perpetuating in certain kinds of discourses of political art activism, many of which we inherited from the late 60s. Reductively, if our focus is primarily on disrupting the system or on establishing our agency outside of the state, where is the place for imagining new forms of systemic connection and democratic governance? That means I'm most interested in social practices that provoke at least reflection on the non-autonomy of human beings, projects that imagine agency not only as systemic disruption, but also as systemic relation. through social art projects that provoke a reflection on the opportunity and inconvenience of our enmeshment in systems of labor, governance, ecology, able-bodiedness, social welfare, public infrastructure, kinship, and more. I'm most interested in situations that induce what I've been calling a kind of infrastructural avowal, that is, an acknowledgement of the interdependent systems of support that are felt both to sustain and to constrain human beings. So I separated, falsely, those aesthetic and social dimensions in order to give a more precise sense of how I like them to combine in the project. Largely, I try to focus on places where questions of social contingency meet those of aesthetic contingency. And more specifically, my hope is that a widely defined terminology around support, that's a key word for me, can bring together questions of both aesthetic and social domains, giving, I hope, a bit more traction to discussions of publicness by reminding ourselves of its role as a supporting apparatus. Interestingly, and as many of you know, in fact, the exposure of the support has a long history in 20th century aesthetics. In visual art history, we find it in Duchamp's interest in calling attention to the supporting apparatus of the museum, as well as in constructivism and later minimalism's attempts to call attention to the supporting apparatus of the frames and wires of the painting, the pedestals of the sculpture, and perhaps most intriguingly, the supporting and interdependent relation between the art object and its receiver. Within that history of discussion around medium-specific questions in art history, the question of where the medium stops and the support begins is always intriguing to me. This visual art history around the exposure of support is matched, of course, by our basics in theater history. For Bertolt Brecht, theater only became an arena of social reflection when the theatrical apparatus was exposed. Debate about the supporting apparatus of society occurred in a theater that was explicit about its interdependence upon its own supporting apparatus, its lighting systems, its backstages, its stage managers. The history of aesthetic interest in support then resonates with the etymology of the term as well as in social theory's vexed relation to a discourse around support. In its etymological history, support is to bear, to hold up, to prop up, with that final word, prop, having resonance in visual and theatrical art histories both. In later definitions, more gerund verbs appear in its definition. The OED goes on to say support is, quote, the action of keeping from falling, exhaustion, or perishing, especially the supplying of a living thing with what is necessary for subsistence, the maintenance of life, unquote. So now, as these definitions continue, there's more sentient possibility in the thing propped up, implying in turn the need for a range of supporting actions beyond those that compensate for the literal pull of gravity. Support here is not only, in art historical terms, undermounted, but also imagined in motion, supplying, maintaining, and as laterally relational. That lateralized dynamic expansion of supporting actions is necessary to sustain an entity that seems to be, for all intents and purposes, living. We could think further now about the support's relation to another key word that has both aesthetic and social resonance, the base, where, of course, Marx and others after him theorized the material and economic structures that acted in a determining relation with the so-called superstructure, a determination that post-Marxist scholars since have worked to unsettle. We could think, too, about the connection between support and the discourse of dependency in social theory. Consider social theorists and historians such as Nancy Fraser, Linda Gordon, and Wendy Brown, who've shown how this discourse raises autonomous personhood as a self-governing ideal against the contingent, disabled citizen, undocumented migrant, or welfare mother who scandalizing requires state support. Such discourses simultaneously mark certain humans as dependent, allowing other citizens to imagine themselves as independent, self-governing, and not in need of support. The perception of autonomy is achieved then through a kind of disavowal, a disavowal of the tax breaks, military pensions, wifely labor, housekeepers, offshoring, and capitalist alienation that allows certain persons to believe themselves to be unfettered and individually responsible for their private success. So these kinds of arguments make the stakes, I think, of infrastructural avowal a bit more clear, and it structured my selection of artists and sites with which to work. The social works project thus lingers longest with projects that have politicized the Duchampian challenge, such as Andrea Fraser's investigations of the museum or William Pope Ell's radical displacements of it. It lingers also on Merle Laterman Ukulis's investigation of maintenance art, and in particular projects on the repressed politics of public sanitation, on Michael Elmgreen and Ingar Dragset's fraught investigation of the role of social welfare in their The Welfare Show, on Santiago Sierra's gallery labors, on Rimini Protocol's investigations of tech support amid the global politics of the call center industry, and on Paul Chan's performance making amid the infrastructural wreckage and levies of FEMA trailers left in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. In these and other cases, I argue that the aesthetic and social questions converge in the psychic and material messiness of what we might call the avowal of support. I'm interested in social practices where the exposure of the aesthetic infrastructure that supports the aesthetic object coincides with the exposure of the social infrastructure that supports human publics. Within this project, though, I've had to come to terms with another factor that brings me back to the paradoxes of our current efforts to argue for the support of public education in California and more widely the debates around social institutions. In fact, it has not always been the case that the language of political expression has used the language of interdependence, or that our contingent relation to institutions and systems have been registered as supporting. Rather, our relation to regulatory systems of governance of social welfare are often registered as invasion, as corruption, or as oppression by the system, or as Berkeley's own Mario Savio famously said, the machine. How then do we argue for systemic relationality when so many are suspicious of system? How do we argue for interdependency when the language of and aspirations toward independence galvanize so much activism and political art making? How might we take a Foucauldian suspicion of regulation into domains where a little more regulation might be called for? So this kind of paradox was crystallized for me by one of my undergraduates who volunteers in a local school and was there the day that her third graders were coloring in signs in anticipation for the state of California's statewide March 4th rally for public education, a day when teachers and parents and citizens, students were all called from kindergarten through higher education to engage in a statewide rally. The sign that struck my student most, penned by her teacher, read, "Hands off my education." That phrase, "hands off," is of course a descendant of an anti-governance sensibility in the United States, one that through various iterations leading from Ronald Reagan's castigation of the government who is here to help you, all the way to today's Tea Parties, has rationalized state disinvestment. Now, the reuse of the hands-off phrase in this context might well have been ironic, but I'm concerned about the ways in which its irony does not read and is not felt. The hands-off language can reductively and oddly allied with a language of progressive resistance, one that might be reductively reading its Foucault or its Gramsci or its free speech movement history and trying to get free of the machine. If there's a danger of a certain kind of anti-statist language in performance studies and in other wings of the critical humanities, i.e. a language that values agency when it resists state structures, then we find ourselves in an unusual position when we are arguing for the reanimation of a state apparatus. How do we square hands off with a simultaneous call for hands-on relationship between public institutions and its citizens? To some degree, this dilemma is embedded in Habermas's own theorizing of the public sphere as a domain outside relations of commerce and outside relations of state governance. That outsidedness to state structures is further advanced in Jeff Elay's, Michael Warner, and to some degree Craig Calhoun's conceptions of counter-public spheres as well. However, the unintended consequences of valuing the public sphere and its counter as state-opposed or state-resistant was anticipated by Nancy Fraser when she offered her conception of the counter-public sphere in an essay that is well-circulated, I'm hoping that many here have read. Curiously, while her theorizing of the social diversity of counter-public spheres is often invoked, and often that is what that essay is remembered for, one point is less often cited, and that is the place where she questions the Habermasian logic that the public sphere is most active when it remains autonomous from the state. If, quote, the bourgeois conception of the public sphere supposes the desirability of a sharp separation between civil society and the state, Fraser writes, it promotes what I shall call weak publics, publics whose deliberative practice consists exclusively in opinion formation but not in decision making. As such, they are unable to form the self-management, interpublic coordination, and political accountability that are essential to a democratic and egalitarian society. Unquote. So there is certainly a normative language in Fraser's articulation that we might want to question, and I certainly wouldn't want to question the importance of maintaining so-called weak publics in certain relations away from state apparatus. But at the same moment, in our formations of public spheres and counter-public spheres and performance studies, arenas that are simultaneously places where we debate the importance of public institutions, we might also want to return to this question of what a relation to the state as a supporting apparatus and vehicle of inter-public coordination might actually mean. The Habermasian sense of the public as a deliberative arena, as an expressive arena, can brace against another sense of the public, the one that is committed to representative government and redistribution, the one that collects taxes and redistributes resources to support the collective values of a society. When the deliberative sense of the public meets the distributive sense of the public, a number of odd behaviors can ensue. And at the University of California, for instance, we might wish for more transparency in a budget and then find ourselves, our eyes glazing over when someone tries to explain it to us. We might say that we want to be consulted more often and then delete the notice for a call for public comment in our email. We might call for a new level of accountability and find ourselves complaining about the new round of bureaucracy it creates. In these and other public contexts, we might find citizens asking for administrators, institutions, and states to get off our backs, then reckon with the fact that we want them to have our backs as well. We might find that budget transparency increases workload in education and other apparatus of governances, where all of us find ourselves suddenly having to think about processes and systems that we'd rather have left to someone else to care for. In trying to frame these moments as part of the difficulty of infrastructural avowal, it seems important to linger on the real dilemmas of this place where public support is enabling and constraining, democratic, but also kind of a pain. It seems important lest we find ourselves, after 30 or more years of scholarship promoting anti-state resistance, occupying a weak public that we might not have realized we had been helping to create. It seems important to ride these paradoxes with a willingness to frame publicness as, in part, a series of supporting relations, relations that sustain entities that are, for all intents and purposes, living. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Am I on? Yes, I am. Thank you so much, Shannon. And again, Shannon's forthcoming book with Rutledge is called Social Works, Performing Art, Supporting Publics. I'm now going to hand over to Janine Marchessault and Michael Prokopow, whose talk today is called Situating Leona Drive, Experimental Communities and Anonymous History.
We're really honored to be able to present our project in this context, and I know I speak for Michael when I thank the organizers for inviting us to do this. The Leona Drive project took place in October 2009, and we're still digesting it. So this is really what you're seeing the beginnings of us digesting. So I thank you in advance for the opportunity to kind of throw some ideas out, and we look forward to having a conversation and to getting feedback. So I'll say a few words about the Leona Drive exhibition. It was It was held in Willowdale, Ontario, which is an old inner suburb in the north part of Toronto. And it's it exists between the Highway 401, which leads out into real suburb land, and the downtown core. And we decided that we wanted to stage a project in that space precisely because of its geographic location. It's also a very mixed demographic in that area. It's an old suburb, but it's also a suburb that has lots of new arrivals. I think it's 65% Asians, and then another 15% Persians and Russians. So it's very, it's not what you would imagine a, you know, stereotypical image of a suburb is. So, we decided we would like to stage an exhibition in a suburban space, and Willowdale is this space that's developing and changing, and what you find in Willowdale are these houses boarded up. So you'll go down a street and you'll find, and this is one, you'll actually often find rows of houses that have been boarded up. And what that is basically, rows of houses have been bought up by developers, and they then apply to have them demolished. Some of these houses, and the houses on Leona Drive, had been vacant for between 5 and 7 years. So we approached the municipal councillor to see if we could get access to the houses, and he put us in touch with the developers, and that was a whole long series of negotiations because, of course, they didn't understand why we would want to have access to these houses and what kind of exhibition could take place. We invited 23 artists to imagine the past of this suburban space, which these houses were built in the 1940s, and my colleague Michael will speak to the architectural history of the houses. The houses were post-war houses. So we asked artists to imagine the past, or to do research into the past, but also to imagine the future of the suburb. Willowdale is filled with. See if I can find some. Well, you're not getting. We'll show you later. Willowdale is filled with high rises, glass office towers, and tiny little small, lovely little bungalows together. So the land had been owned by different developers over the years, and one of the aims of our exhibition was to tell the story of the city through the history of its developments, not unlike what the Swiss architectural historian Siegfried Gideon has done by telling the history of modernity through patents. So now these houses have been demolished, and this was the final stage in our exhibition. And in their place will stand 8 faux Victorians. And we sort of trace the history of the development of these houses. There was supposed to be an apartment building, a high rise, an old age home. And at each stage, the residents got involved in blocking the development. A few months ago, we staged a panel up at York and invited several of the artists to think about what they had done. And we were accused of being nostalgic. And the comment is interesting, since the etymology of nostalgic refers us to homesickness. The original meaning of homesickness derives from soldiers missing home, and is a notion that's bound up with memories. So I think that this Leona Drive project is very much about homesickness. So our talk today is going to focus on 3 aspects of the exhibition. I apologize for the slides. Michael is kind of hogging. He took all of the good slides for his presentation, and he said to me, "You don't need slides." So you'll get a nice image of the whole exhibition. You're not just stuck with me. So our aim is to focus on 3 aspects. First, the sense of history, and public space that is taken up and created by the exhibition, the methodology and historical research into urban space that we were able to undertake by staging this site-specific exhibition, and concepts of experimental community that the exhibition called forth. As Shamin has written about democracy and urban public spheres, and his ideas helped us to develop differentiated approaches to thinking about public urban space. A lot of the more contemporary writing on public sphere, which thinks about intermediality, will often denigrate the notion of the public in the context of our virtual world. So people are talking about the commons, but public is actually the usefulness of the term public, and the usefulness of the concept of a public sphere is called into question. So we look to Ashamin's latest essay, which is called Collective Culture and Urban Public Space, focusing specifically on material space, in which he argues for the continued importance of public space as a catalyst for political participation, for demos, for face-to-face encounters. However, his approach to thinking about the public is conceived from a post-humanist perspective. He's less concerned with the classical idea of the public sphere as a place where strangers encounter one another than he is with, quote, the entanglement between people and material and visual culture and the visual culture of public space. Amin offers four keywords for analyzing the vitality of public space in a situation, in a locale. The first is multiplicity, which refers to the extent to which the space is open to a plurality and diversity of the world, as well as openness to the mixed use of space. The second is symbolic solidarity, which addresses the manner in which space is open to symbolic projections, not of the powerful, not of advertising, but of the marginal, which speaks to tolerance. Thirdly is conviviality, which refers not simply to pleasant interactions, but is, quote, the shared experience of the well-stocked and sage park or street and community center or library. It's a brush with multiplicity, not simply based on interest in the possibilities of serendipity and chance, which is an intrinsic aspect of multiplicity and of the city, but of the gains to be had from access to collective resources, the knowledge that more does not become less through usage, the assurance of belonging to a larger fabric of urban life. And finally, there is technological maintenance. These refer to the fact that the city is a machine which regulates and orders the life world, from postcodes, pipes, cables, satellites, commuting patterns, computers, telephones, software, databases, all these things that regulate urban provisioning by setting the delivery systems, internet protocols, rituals of civic and public conduct, family routines, and cultures of workplace and residence. Citizens only notice these structures when they break down, but within them, Amin argues, we can detect the manner in which certain people and things are valued and serviced, sometimes above others, in the city. We can feel the structure of the city when we don't have those services. When we do, they're simply invisible. They're what Nigel Thrift calls the technological unconscious, and they're laced with identities, supply, and functionality. These four aspects, multiplicity, symbolic solidarity, conviviality, technological maintenance, for discerning the vitality of public space in a locale. And again, we were attracted to Amin's essay because it's less theoretical than it is a methodology for actually engaging with material and the specificities of material public space, because public space is not something which is generalizable, but increasingly I think we need to look at the way public space is enacted in different cities, in different cultures, in different nations. Yet there seems to be something missing from Amin's proposal for reanimating public space that is akin to what Siegfried Krakauer called anonymous history. And this was at the very heart of what I think we learned from the Leona Drive project. Gideon's notion of anonymous history was first developed in his book, Building in France, Building in Iron, Building in Pharaoh Concrete, published in 1928, where he described architectural form as both anonymous and collective. The history of industrial architecture rests with the unnamed engineers and builders who shaped the 19th century. Suddenly, with mass culture, there is the city itself, the material culture which surrounds us, everyday objects become anonymous. This anonymity is an inherent aspect of the modern industrial environment. And again, this was at the heart, this anonymity was at the heart of finding these houses and what we wanted to explore. The source of Gideon's insights comes from the practices of the Surrealists and the Bauhaus, for which objects and things were embedded in and with the energies of historical forces. Through these objects, through the networks that enabled an object to appear, and there are hundreds of networks stored in an object, from the extraction of natural resources to the labor that produced the object, from ways of storing things to ways of moving things, Gideon maintains that one has access to life itself. Gideon tells us, quote, that the meaning of history arises from the uncovering of relationships. These relations will vary with the shifting point of view, for like constellations of stars, they are ceaselessly in change. History, regarded as insight, he writes, into the moving process of life draws closer to biological phenomenon. So this concept of anonymous history is conceived as a dynamic cultural ecology. And we could read the architectural and material aspects of Leona Drive as a kind of living archive. And I'll just say a few words about the methodology and how the project was initiated. It started with a group called LOT, Experiments in Urban Research. And there were about 10 of us that began to meet 2 years ago to think about different ways of analyzing the city, obviously under the influence of Henri Lefebvre and some of his methodologies for analyzing cities like rhythm analysis, for example. And as I said earlier, we went into Willowdale and we wanted to work in a suburb because these are the places where there is dynamic growth, where entire streets disappear overnight and where high-rise buildings are suddenly appear. So before doing that project, we undertook small experiments, and we decided to divide ourselves into three groups and that would engage in terms of place, engage with different levels that could correspond to the base superstructure model, but in fact is really much simpler than that. And it is to one group focused on air, which is the wireless city, which is cell phone towers, which is radio. Another group focused on the ground, which was looking at the built environment, looking at the design of streets. And another group focused on the underground, which is actually history, which is the basis for all the structures that are there. So that's where the Leona Drive project started, is really in the underground area. And we went, when we finally got access to these houses, we went into one of the houses that was open, and we went right into the basement, and we found the reminiscences of a woman's life who had lived there for 40 years. And we also, there was another group that went into the archives, went into the deep, dark vaults and dug out the maps, dug out photographs of the area. So from there, I'm going to pass this over to Michael, who will speak more specifically about the projects.
I apologize to my colleague for taking all the slides. I think when you're at a loss for words, you hope that images will suffice. Janine did a superb job of setting up a structure for the understanding of Leona. This project reminds me of something Greg Denning, the Australian cultural historian, mentioned, that history is always about the volitional performance of intent And even though things can happen within history that are accidental and unexpected, ultimately the collage that constitutes human existence can be excavated and interrogated to find hidden meaning. Leona Drive is a site-specific project sought to interrogate, as Professor Marceau explained, a type of suburban existence which in many ways has passed away. These houses, sitting on cul-de-sacs that one, if you think about Lewis Mumford's commentary, exist as these type of pastiches of banal middle-class bourgeois conformity. I think Mumford makes the idea that people, you know, have food in plastic containers and replicate the same behaviors day in and day out. What we found in looking at Leona Drive as a site was the intersection of past, present, and future. And in that sense, one can understand this site-specific project as a type of three-dimensional time experience. If you remember in the first Star Trek, there was a three-leveled chess set, and only Spock could play all three levels at one point. If you use that as a metaphor for getting at Leona, what we think about as a type of site-specific art project was trying to marry this halcyon middle-class memory of the suburbs with the demographic and striking changes of what's called the New Canada, Willowdale being a white Protestant middle-class neighborhood being transformed into a place of multicultural identity and democratic promise. When we arrived at the site, and I'm going to talk very quickly because I know I have very little time, it was an overgrown place. The houses, as Janine said, were abandoned for between 5 and 8 years. What used to be lovely, pristine middle-class gardens were then run amok overgrown hay and weeds and brambles and all. But in fact, there was life within this. And in the back of one of the houses, we found a type of reenactment of bourgeois sensibility, an old ratty couch, an old ratty sofa, a packing crate used as a small coffee table. And this was what was known as PJ's Fuck Palace. And on the back of one of the buildings was this remarkable piece of graffiti art. And if you can't read it, I'll read it. It says, "Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, speed, weed, and birth control. Life's a bitch, and then you die. Fuck this shit, and let's get high." And in the back of this Leona Drive place, which once was a site of domesticity, returning vets from the Second World War, marrying their brides, raising their families, 2.3 children, wonderful conformity, dereliction, new economic possibilities for a developer, you found PJ and his entourage creating a new world within an old one. In organizing it, we had any number of meetings over the course of a year to figure out how we could take this wonderful opportunity, access to this site, and turn it into something that would be meaningful, both as a living history museum of Toronto, a type of mobile examination of a dramatic metropolis, but also at the same time giving artists, remarkable people working across media, the opportunity to come up with something that both commented on the specificity of suburbs past and present, but also about larger issues of social life. So very quick images of what was happening. What was remarkable to my mind about Leona, and this is in the context of what I now understand to be performance studies, was that it was both a planned exercise, a curated art project that took on a life of its own and which was the sort of marriage between the intentional and the happenstance. What was so interesting for me as a curator, and I'm not exactly annually retentive, but I do like a list of things to happen. The list was formed and then it went by the way because things unfolded in unexpected and ultimately poetic and enlivening ways. Artists were invited to do things that corresponded with memories and identities found in the house. Professor Marceau explains that in the basement of number 9, there were abandoned objects, a trunk of papers and photographs from a woman named Ruth Gillespie, who was widowed and who loved life in the 1950s, and who died tragically, but perhaps appropriately, on the dance floor. One of the artists, a man named Ryan Livingston, a student here at the Ontario College of Art and Design University, sought to evoke memories of the 1950s, a la his grandmother, whose favorite outfit was a polka dot dress, and who every Friday night in rural New Brunswick would put that dress on, make a martini for her husband, and they would put on music. So Ryan was given a room in the house and decided to paint 14,950 pennies white, mount them on pin-headed nails to create this room of dots in memory of Ruth. Other artists sought to explore issues of femininity and female experience within the suburbs, that tension between autonomy and sort of patriarchal duty. If you remember, Betty Friedan in The Feminine Mystique suggests that in the period after World War II, American women experienced what she calls their re-Victorianization. It might be argued in the Canadian context that women were never not Victorian, but somehow what's so striking about these suburban houses is that one could sense the duty. And in the process of this project, we had any number of original occupants come to the site. They sort of came out of nowhere. Husbands had died, they'd gone into retirement homes, they'd downsized, but they came back to Leona to explain to us why it was important that they live there, and how, even though the suburbs have a bad rap in the public imagination in this day and age, in fact, these were good places. People were proper, they knew manners, families were together, and all of these things. This is by the artist Christine Davis, who decided to paint an upstairs bathroom in lipstick in the post-World War II period. One of the cosmetic companies produced something called Victory Red, the idea of a type of patriotic lipstick for women. Christine, with her hands, painted an entire bathroom with this lipstick. In the kitchen of Ruth Gillespie's house, Shannon McDonald and Angela Josie, using the archival materials found in the basement, created this remarkable interactive installation that explored domesticity and memory. The site overall was baleful. Another artist in the project decided to create a type of commentary using what is a type of now commonplace sign. These are the zoning notices that one finds throughout Toronto explaining that this house is going to be demolished and a new 50-story condominium building will be put up. But here the text talks about how to consider a proposed zoning, the culture of good placemaking, like the period in which this neighborhood, culture of farming or agriculture, and so on and so forth. And what was so striking about this piece of work, it was installed in front of one of the derelict houses, and most people who came to the site, some 3,500 to 4,000 visitors, walked right by this thing. And I think that was the artist's intent. The Calgary-based collective, the Arbor Lake School, decided to create what they called their post-apocalyptic suburb and literally took one of the houses apart, which you will see. Another artist explored the basement using images of equipment and creating these sort of crevices and dust holes with sound. The idea of multiculturalism in the Toronto. In the bay window of the house, we were using this remarkable installation using Owen Jones's ornament, grammar of ornament, to create a type of juxtaposed tableau of the Muslim world within a white, or less and less white middle class suburb. Phototelemetry. I know in 2 minutes. So I'll just go through these. History making in this place. We had a psychic come in who channeled Ruth unexpectedly and revealed things. We had visitors from nature. One of the artists, Ante Liu, decided to paint a house like a Monopoly piece, suggesting that ultimately in the economics of suburban transformation, it is all about capitalism and the sort of transformation of life. Visitors, as we suggested, we had between 4,500. Daniel Borns and Jennifer Marmon commenting on a house in Etobicoke, one of the Toronto suburbs, which has had the good fortune or misfortune of having a house go through the front room window 3 times, decided to create an installation where they put up a car through the front. We had high school students who came and installed art above things found in houses. An image of Ryan Livingston's room. Carpenters, archivists, gardeners. We turned Leona Drive into a place that brought the public. And as a historian, the idea of site-specific work intrigues me because, as I say, I sort of anticipated a certain type of public reaction, which was not the case. It became one giant conversation about community. And in that sense, if you think about performance and site specificity, what Leona Drive did was encourage people to bring their stories, to come and think about suburban life, to think about stereotypes and opportunity and community, and to take away ideas about themselves within the broader world. Here is just the cutaway. If you think about the excavation that constitutes Leona Drive in a critical sense, the Arbor Lake School decided with hacksaws and hammers to take the side of a house off. And inside, we know that this was sort of a drug den and all, and it was revealed to the public, much to the chagrin of the developers. An installation, a remarkable installation, photomontage, a type of bourgeois interior in a derelict structure. David Hand's piece, taking a script, and I'll be done very quickly. David Hand took a script from Father Knows Best, and in which the wife learns to drive. He translated into the 5 most spoken immigrant languages in Canada, Farsi, Korean, Mandarin, etc., and created this car where you would sit in it and the video projections on the side and the front with this loop in various languages with the script from Father Knows Best translated. At night, Leona Drive took on a life of its own. We illuminated the backyard. We never thought we would use the back gardens because they were so sort of overgrown and inaccessible, but we realized it would be a very nice way to link these five houses by creating pathways through the trees. We had arborists come, landscape architects, and there was this remarkable thing. Patricio Davilio of Oakhead's remarkable installation. Another visitor. People. Site map of the early 20th century plans for sort of garden suburbs never realized in this neighborhood. People. This piece, Tomczak and Steele's Terminus, the idea that Leona Drive being redeveloped constitutes both the end of something and the beginning of something. And maybe that's always the nature of performance. Performances always have a start, a middle, and an ending. And here's the ending of Leona Drive as of 4 weeks ago. The 1947 CMHC bungalows in their wonderful uniformity demolished to be replaced by townhomes at $1 million. And you can see in this last image this sort of replicated historicism. If the 1950s suburb was for North America the promise of modernity, that modernity in late postmodernism has been replaced by a type of historicist pastiche. And so these townhomes with their evocation of Victorian sensibility might be simply the same old thing, but different. Thank you very much.
Thank you to Janine and Michael. Some of you might be looking at your watches and wondering how on earth we're going to make this. I just want to let you know that I've been informed we have a very long break after this plenary, so we're going to indulge ourselves and take an extra 10 minutes or so. So we're going to go till about 10 after 11. So I now want to introduce our final speaker. Well, I've already introduced him. I'll just say Jose Munoz. He's standing right there. And his paper today is called The Affective Life of Brownness, Sonia Sotomayor with Mario Montes.
Hi. I want to thank everyone on the planning committee who invited me. I'm happy to be here. Good morning. This talk's called Wise Latinas. Mario's my Mises, Sonia's stand. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor nomination to the Supreme Court of the United States was met with great skepticism by the North American right wing. There was no small part due to her use of the self-description, wise Latina. When describing her qualifications as a jurist, it would seem that the term Latina and its linkage to a term usually associated with more universal subjects was precisely the site of provocation for her conservative foes. We are left to conclude that wise, the word reserved to for a subject who claims a more objectivist mode of knowledge production. This paper focuses on what I'd like to describe as a performance of otherwiseness. By otherwiseness, I mean to render a discussion of the production and performance of knowledge that does not conform to the mimetic coordinates assigned to both the designations wise and other. I want to sketch another, more subterranean route to the production of knowledge. To this end, I cast an odd Puerto Rican predecessor to Justice Sonia Sotomayor, underground screen and theater legend Mario Montes. The paper meditates upon Montes' embodied production and performance of knowledge during select moments during his work with both Jack Smith and Andy Warhol. I turn to Montes as an important an indexical moment that allows us to imagine the public culture of Latinidad as affective otherwiseness. The performance moments I consider display Montes' performance as that of affective particularity that displaces much of the coercive mimeticism that structures North American understandings of this concept, Latinidad. And I know it has different resonances up here. The paper draws a crooked line between Montes and Sotomayor and names a mode of knowledge production, otherwiseness, which gives us a richer account of feeling and being brown in the world. And this paper, I should indicate, is from a larger project called Feeling Brown, which is about the affective contours of difference at this particular moment in the U.S. This idea of Brown, as I unpack it, is hopefully a theory that will travel and speak to other situations of alterity. And finally, I should also say this work is part of a larger collective endeavor called the Public Feelings Project, which is a group of loosely affiliated scholars at different universities in the States. We get together, we have conferences, we talk about our approaches, our methodologies, and this certainly comes out of that conversation. Before I tell parallel tales of Montez and Sotomayor's Star Turn performances, especially the staging of both their big auditions for career-making cameras, I wish to give some coordinates for this presentation. The linkage for feeling and being Brown is crucial to the larger sequence of writings this paper belongs to. No simple idea of Latino ontology makes any sense unless it's linked to a phenomenological field. We know Latinidad, or what I alternatively call Brownness, through its affective contours, which is to say the set of collective and often contagious responses to one's emotional and personal situation. The set of collective and often contagious responses to one's historical and emotional situation. The relay of responses is once again knowable to us as a kind of affective performativity, which is to say a kind of feeling which is a mode of doing. Certain publics, like those who provisionally go here under the sign Latino, share historical trajectories of negotiating particular sets of material obstacles in the social, which include, but are not limited to, uneven distribution of resources, systemic race, nation, and language-based bias, unjust and phobic immigration policies, and a general tendency to be scapegoated unjust and phobic immigration policies, and a general tendency to be scapegoated during a nation state's moments of economic or cultural instability. And right now in the United States, the great example of this is, of course, the fine state of Arizona, and its particularly fascist policies get hit the fan. Thus, I'm interested in a mode of affective particularity that I'm describing as Brownness, and this focus leads me to the project of describing particular performances of Brown feeling that produce knowledge about singularities and publics that do not conform to anticipatable notions of reason. But these alternative and often subterranean paths to knowledge production are, I want to insist, not reason's other, the simple rejection of reason as a majoritarian project, as a counter-public stance, seems too easy and indeed counterproductive. Such a move simply shores up simplistic dyads of contagion and motion that I would like to interrupt. More nearly, my aim for the route of affect is imagining a provincial de-universalizing of reason for the express purpose of imagining and describing multiple modes of being, feeling, and knowing the world. The uproar over Sonia Sotomayor's now infamous line, the one she repeated in a few academic contexts over a span of about 5 years, the assertion that she hoped that a wise Latina woman might reach better conclusions than white males without the same experience, points to calcified oppositions to the convergence of particularized, and in this case, gendered and ethnic experience and wisdom and its loose cognates, knowledge and reason. For many of us who have been toiling in the fields of race, sex, and other minoritarian modes of knowledge production, the rite's rancor read as a strange validation of the work and our shared project, the potential for it to interrupt and challenge certain protocols. A particular de-universalizing around wisdom, a particularizing of reason itself, was a very controversial and exploitable proposition, certainly cuts to the core of so many debates that structure our political moment. The neoconservative tack suggested that Justice Sotomayor would rule from a position of empathy and experience. the realm of the affective, not the law with all its nominal claims to objectivity and universalism. With the right wing's framing, empathy, emotion, and the particular are wisdom's other. Briefly reading within the right's protocols of argumentation, I want to think about the knowledge wise Latinas and other non-universal subjects produce as a kind of otherwiseness. This idea of otherwise is particularly indebted to the work of recent interventions in critical race theory. For example, Candace Chu's framing of an anti-identitarian Asian American studies based on a mode of critique that eschews the subject and calls for a collective understanding of ethnic particularity through the project of imagining otherwise. Equally important is Ray Chow's notion of a coercive mimesis that understands ethnicity itself as a captivity narrative, one which is called upon the minority subject within capitalism. Legal theorist Richard T. Ford understands this phenomenon in terms of a minority subject's, quote, compelled performance before the law. Both Chow and Ford's paradigms are grafted onto a Lacanian analysis in Antonio Viego's Dead Subjects. In Viego's lens, the affective performance of Latina otherwiseness represents what he would call the hysterics discourse, a discourse that potentially interrupts the compelled performances and coercive mimesis that structure reality for racialized subjects. And this, again, is hopefully a theory that moves beyond the configuration of brownness that I'm talking about, but speaks to a lot of other minoritarian lives in the public sphere. As we know, the conservatives' attack on Sotomayor's nomination fell short. She was approved 68-31. This paper wants to look at Sotomayor's performance on the stand and think of it in relationship to the performance of those Republican senators who questioned her. I want to look at this as a moment of two different performances of public affect collided. I take instruction when considering this case by looking at a slightly unpredictable precedent, Andy Warhol's screen test number two. And here's the weird thing I'm doing. I'm talking about public life now, but I'm using the history of the avant-garde as an instruction manual. Because obviously I have to keep it interesting. I turn to the avant-garde precursor to the major court case for a few reasons. Chiefly among them is the impulse to link Latino popular culture and politics with aesthetic traditions that intrinsically challenge the coercive mimesis that so hampers Latino and ethnic studies. Thus, a turn to the avant-garde as a way to try to displace this kind of coercive, predictable, compulsory performance that people of color have to deal with all the time. Mariel's mimesis, her performance of affective particularity in the face of Ron Tavel's show business grilling, tells us another story of Latinidad that is not a heroic fable, but instead an account of a canny performance of otherwiseness in the face of majoritarian scrutiny. When asked by Gerard Malonga to name his greatest superstar, Andy Warhol named Mariel Montez. When asked why, Warhol responded it was because he immediately enlisted the audience's sympathy. Montez was a central figure in the New York avant-garde in the 1960s. He was born Rene Rivera in 1935. Legend has it that Montez was a Puerto Rican civil servant who was born in an extremely Catholic family. Montez met Jack Smith, the father/mother of the New York Underground, while they were cruising, I might add. Montez and Smith shared a love of Hollywood B movies. Their great icon was the Dominican Spitfire, Maria Montez, right, who's very famous for her over-the-top exotic persona. And movies like Cobra Woman, which is one of the best movies ever. Mariel Montez selected his name as a tribute to the green screen goddess. Montez met Warhol through Smith, and this led to them making films together. In 1965, they did Screen Test number two, and it featured Ronald Tavel, who recently passed, the wonderful Ronald Tavel, who was part of the ridiculous collaborated with Ludlum, with Vaccaro, and Warhol. Vaccaro is interviewing Montez off-screen. It's a stationary camera. We only see Montez's face. That's the only performance we see. But Tavel is very active. And the whole screen test is an audition for a remake of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, where Tavel is auditioning Montez for the role of Esmeralda, right? And I think I'm going to show that clip now, if technology permits me. I'm pressing a button. Okay. Actually, you should press the button. This is about 5 minutes. It's the second reel of screen test number two, which is 60 minutes long, but we're going to see like 4 minutes. Okay. Oh, we lost it. Can we get sound? Is there no sound set?
Now, to Mr. Montez, there's one scene in this movie, quite important, where you are peacefully sleeping in the Tower of Notre Dame, in the cathedral. Now, let's have you sleeping, please. Sleeping. Close your eyes. Close your eyes. Sleep. Sleep. Dream peacefully. You are dreaming of the handsome Captain Phoebus, the sun, the beautiful blonde captain. Dream on, beautiful, young, lovely gypsy girl. Dream, dream, dream. Suddenly, you are awakened by a hand that is placed on you. And you open your eyes. That's it. That's it. And you think... And you see the ugly hunchback is screaming. Suddenly, you are awakened by a hand that is placed on you.
How do I do that?
And you open your eyes. That's it. That's it. And you see... not the beautiful cat! The ugly hunchback! And you see the ugly hunchback is screaming! Beautiful inside. You know that. know.
I'm going to stop here. Sorry about that. And I'm going to... I'm sorry? Okay, kind of. Okay. Tavel is, throughout this interviewing Montez, he begins his interview that we just saw a little piece of, where he asks him to yell as though he saw the Hunchback for the first time. And he begins by asking her, "Miss Montez, how do you feel?" He responds by breathlessly saying, "I feel like I'm in another world of fantasy, like a kingdom meant to be ruled by me, like I could give orders and suggest ideas." Montez's opening gambit is a dreamy insistence on feeling otherwise, a certain belonging to a world where she is not subordinated because of his position in the social, but instead existing in a sphere that is meant to be ruled by me. Where Montez gives orders and has ideas. Tavel indulges this vibe for quite a while, and we see the screaming. Later, Tavel gets Montez to say the word diarrhea repeatedly, to act like a gypsy, to do a whole bunch of different things. But throughout, Montez seems to be enjoying this treatment. He never stops playing along. The whole film leads to the fantasy of this world where his agency is heard and counted otherwise, right? In a way, the grilling that happens here is then reminiscent for me of the kind of grilling that Sotomayor got. Remember, one of the things Tavel did in his audition to Montez was have her repeat the word diarrhea repeatedly. And this is part of the juvenilism of it all. And so now I'm going to go to my closer. As I suggested at the talk's onset, I saw a lot of Montez and Tavel during last summer's Senate confirmation hearings for Sonia Sotomayor. Certainly, it can be said that the Republicans made her speak quite a bit of diarrhea. They made a point of having her sell out her own sponsor, Obama, by saying that empathy had no place in legal judgment, that instead reason and only the law should be applied. They split many on the left. I myself am of two minds on the question. The skeptic in me saw the speaking of diarrhea as the quickest and safest path to confirmation, while the idealist in me felt that there was something profoundly wrong about selling out empathy and the world of emotion, particularly all it represented. When asked about the judge's impending nomination, the Republican senator from North Carolina, Lindsey Graham, said she would be confirmed if she avoided a meltdown. Meltdowns have been the traditional province of women and ethnics, even though the last few months in popular and political culture have been replete with fascinating and magical white male meltdowns. They stole that from us. It seems that women and people of color are no longer own that. Pleading allegiances to feelings is dangerous. In a New York Times op-ed, the bizarre Maureen Dowd wrote, reading the confirmation hearings, that any clever job applicant knows you must obscure as well as reveal. So she sidestepped the dreaded empathy question, even though that was what the president wants from her. Watching those hearings, I could not help but think of Montez and Tavel's mock interview, and the very real one televised. Many of us who felt any commonality with the judge understood the game being played was like a dynamic between tranny hustler and John, who knows but just doesn't want to know. In both cases, the players kept to the script, right? How does a wise Latina respond to this kind of ignorance cloaked in power? One more moment I can't show you because I don't have time would be the YouTube clip where the senator from Oklahoma says, "Lucy, you got some splaining to do," right? And how she responds to that, which is super chilly, which is great. This is all on YouTube, by the way. So how does a wise Latina respond to that kind of ignorance cloaked in power? I think that remains an open question, but certainly a case worth studying is Sotomayor's icy performance, her refusal to be intimidated or melt down. I see this as weirdly resonating with Montez's performance of aloof spaciness, which is not to say that the iciness and spaciness are the same thing, but both represent an anti-anticipatory response to the dominant affect, a feeling of performing publicness, a public self otherwise, and thus I see the cases of Sotomayor and Montez as examples of the performance of otherwiseness, which is to say, the sort of wisdom in and through feelings that can potentially enable us to negotiate many of the hostile interviews that life offers us. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jose. Okay, so we're now going to steal 10 minutes from our break. If you need to Zoom, please Zoom quietly now. But I want to invite anyone with questions to please throw up your hands and feel free to come forward to the microphones that we've got here. Fantastic. We have a taker. In amongst the exodus,
is it on?
We have a question. Go ahead. I'll give you 10 seconds to scurry.
Okay. This is a question for Professor Jackson. I find the idea of structural support, which you're using to discuss these social practices, to be a really, really interesting and productive one. And part of what I find so productive about it is the way that I understand you trying to put an emphasis on the very material nature of these structures. And so I'm wondering, within that, within these material structures of support that the social artwork can avow, what the specific role is of the materiality of the human body and the different materialities of the human body as opposed to the other material aspects of that support, and whether or not this supporting material of the human body that plays a really key role in social artworks, that body as a thinking and sensing body has a sort of privileged relationship to the intersection of the aesthetic and the political that's at stake in these practices.
Thank you. Great question. Just really briefly so we can get to others. I think that this project is, I think, in conversation with, but also it follows perhaps a different kind of path than what might be called the sort of live art theorizing around the body. So that on the one hand, it's very much informed and helped by all that has been discussed and offered by so many people around the role of the body in live art, in body art performance, etc. I'm interested in retaining the sense of embodiment. I think that I'm interested in placing it often in these projects, which tend to be less about singular bodies doing one live work, but more about relational group interactions, that the bodies tend to be in sort of processes of collaboration and social action that, as I said earlier, sort of sustain the social work, right? So that I think that part of what I often find myself questioning is a certain kind of discourse that we inherited from, say, a visual art discourse that called the turn to the performative dematerializing in this odd way, so that for us to release from the art object in order to have bodies in space, there was this sort of language of dematerialization came forward, and there is part of me that wants to ask for what angle of vision would see that as dematerializing when the body is another form of materialization. And at the same time, I think that talking about the body in this way is emphasizing not only perhaps the pores, the skin, et cetera, but the role of the pores, senses, and skin as a kind of labor, I suppose, that in many ways the bodies involved are working ones. So it's
okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yes.
Thank you all for your presentations. I have an observation, and it kind of relates to both what Professor Jackson and Professor Munoz were saying. I was really struck by what Montez was saying about when the director asked him how he felt that he had this fantasy of a kingdom ruled by me, where his agency is heard and counted otherwise. And it reminded me of what Shannon was saying about autonomy and the difficulties of institutional avowal and this desire of a kind of autonomous realm of otherwise affect that doesn't have to do with law or reason or something like that. And it linked into my mind in the dilemma that you found yourself in response to Sotomayor's performance about like the skeptic and the idealist, right? Like having those two sort of, a kind of binarized inside and outside to, you know, the possibility of feeling in response to it. And so I guess I was just wondering if either of you had anything to say about that problem of the language of autonomy and being ruled by me and kingdomness when avowing a kind of avowing a kind of empathic understanding of the law, perhaps.
That's a great question. Thank you. And actually, I would have really been hard-pressed to link my paper with Shannon's, and I think that was a really good job at doing that. So thank you for that. I think, you know, if we think about the question that I understand you asking, Sharon, Shannon, about how the real ambivalences and antagonisms we feel towards the state at the same time as we're asking the state to back us and support us, right? Mm-hmm. It seems that where does the aesthetic come in? And the aesthetic is the realm, I think, where we can pretend to begin to schematize and negotiate that very real contradiction, right, of having a very antagonistic and hostile experience of being in the state, belonging to the state, and at the same time understanding it as the field we have to work within, right, for real material, immediate reasons, right? And what I see in the screen test is a kind of sphere where this stuff could be rehearsed, tried out, mm-hmm. experimented with, right? And it's through this kind of screen of excessive feeling, right? Non-normative affective comportment.
Go ahead, Fred.
I feel I need to react, not really with a comment, because as the panel went along, I felt that it started on a very high note, but as it went along, I felt it was more like not PSI, but PS Urban North America, a very specific selection of the issues of the public sphere, and from having all my life felt brown in my own special way, I felt blue.
I'm sorry you felt blue. And again, the whole idea is we write from our sites of analysis where we do our research projects. We can't do everyone else's research project, of course. Hopefully, maybe someone who doesn't feel brown in the same exact way as I do can find some recourse and use in my investigations.
Thanks. Laura, should I speak to that? Yeah? Well, considering we've only got a couple of minutes, I'll have to be really quick about this, but I think, I hope I speak for the organizing committee when I say that we wanted to
find a selection of scholars and artists to speak to the issues of publicness, the issues that PSI investigates, that performance studies scholars around the world investigate right now, but also to our particular situatedness here in Toronto. And I think it's for that very particular reason that we invited Janine and Michael to speak about Leona Drive. And I have to say, as someone who saw the Leona Drive project in the fall, I was certainly moved to think about a variety of issues in a variety of different kinds of context as a result of that work. And I really want to thank you guys for the work as well as your presentation. I want to thank all of you for your presentations, and I think we're going to have to cap it there because I am in danger of turning into a pumpkin. Thank you all for being with us.